Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. This week, the Santa Fe Opera is performing a different opera every night. So this week on the Radio Cafe, we're running our opera series with Desiree Mays, talking about the opera that's on stage tonight. I'd like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book now in its 12th year that comes out every year to accompany the five operas of the Santa Fe Opera season. Desiree lectures nightly at the Preview Buffet of the Santa Fe Opera. She's an international lecturer and spends much of the winter season lecturing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And she's tour director of Act One Tours, which takes people all over the world to see opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Today we're talking about the opera Madame Butterfly by Puccini. And I just wanted, I looked Puccini up, and his name is Giacomo Antonio Domenico Michele Segundo Maria Puccini.
How about that? Repeat, please. It's very musical.
Secondo, not Segundo.
Yeah, right.
But wow, so he's somebody, I always think of him as a 19th century composer, but he lived until 1924, and Madame Butterfly is set in the first few years of the 20th century.
That's right. It's interesting. He's writing Madame Butterfly at about the same time that Richard Strauss is writing Salome. And if you think of the comparison of those two operas, that's sort of mind-boggling. There's always questions about who Puccini's influences were. He's seen the natural person for him to be would be the successor to Verdi, who died at the turn of the century. When he heard Verdi died, he went immediately and was one of the key people at that funeral. But it's probably Wagner who had greater influence on Puccini. Wagner's work was beginning to be heard, and most people were creating about it. They didn't know what it was about and on the whole didn't like it. But he saw the potential there and began to include some of the Wagnerian techniques in his operas. I don't think that's so clear in Madama Butterfly. This came earlier in his career. He had a number of successes by this point. He was now a famous composer. And Madama Butterfly maybe ran into terrible troubles at the first night at the premiere in 1904 because it was booed. I mean, it was terrible. It was a disastrous premiere, which is so extraordinary for this opera, which is one of the top 10, probably top 5 operas of all time. And there were many reasons for that. But maybe part of the reason was, this is true, that there was a cluck. These were people who were in the house there just to make trouble, to boo and shout and throw things, and were sent and sometimes paid by rival composers. So that was going on. And in fact, when I was in La Scala just last month with Simone Boccanegra and Placido Domingo, which you think everything would be plain sailing, the Milanese audience did not like the conductor. And they booed him loudly and roundly. And I thought, maybe he won't even come on stage at the end. He did. He came on stage, he crossed his arms, and he stood center stage, and he sort of glared them down. So this is a sort of a continuation of the clack, not the clack, but of the Milan La Scala audience, which is a brutal audience. To this day, the greatest singers are still intimidated by singing there. And for Puccini, it was a disaster. I mean, he had better times later on. But Madama Butterfly flopped. They call it a diabetic opera. He had just been diagnosed with diabetes, and all sorts of terrible things were happening in his private life. But this great, wonderful work
That was
flopped.
Mean.
Mean, very mean. Yes, that's the way it was.
We're awfully polite in comparison.
We are, yes. I've never seen... Well, I've seen the Met audiences a little sort of booing. You do get that now, but they're usually overwhelmed by the applause, and the reviews tend to ignore the boos. So
right.
It's interesting.
So this is a play, an opera, a story set in Japan in the early 1900s, and the story has roots that are much older than that, and we'll talk about that. But basically, an American military guy, just for fun and just for the kind of lust and adventure of it, marries and knocks up a 15-year-old Japanese girl who comes from a noble family, but her family's fallen on hard times, and breaks her heart to little pieces, which we have to basically sit through for 2 hours.
Oh, it's not that bad, Marisha. I haven't turned you on to this only yet. We'll work on
that. No, I've seen it. I have seen it. And it's, I mean...
You've seen it on film. You haven't
seen
it.
That's right.
So there is that. And actually, it wasn't quite that simple. Pinkerton, Lieutenant Benjamin Franklin Pinkerton, was a naval lieutenant for the U.S. Army. And he had this attitude of having a girl in every port. It's what they did. You know, in the original story, they talk about, well, what are the girls like in this country? And the Japanese... it was a closed society at this time in the 1800s, and they really had no way of dealing with these sailors who came ashore looking for prostitutes, because there is no equivalent in the Japanese culture. So they came up with this sort of arrangement whereby someone like Pinkerton would arrive and he would meet a marriage broker, Goro in this case, who would show him pictures of girls, and he'd choose one, and then they would arrange a sort of a marriage contract. It was a real contract in which... He made sure about the terms of this contract. He said the lease in the contract was for 999 years.
Should he live so long?
But he could get out at a month's notice, and he knew his ship leave was only 3 weeks. He neglects to tell Butterfly this little detail, of course. She thinks it's for life. That was one aspect. He goes and inspects the house, and he thinks this is nice. He's going to have servants, and he sort of makes fun of them. He does not take it seriously. Now, on her side, it's interesting. She is not a geisha, for starters. Geishas were higher class, if you like. They didn't have casual relationships like this. They were great artists of music and culture.
Well, what do you mean casual relationships? She married the guy.
No, but she was not a geisha. She was more what would be termed a tea house entertainer. So she would play the samisen, she would sing, she would wear these gorgeous gowns. And in this case, Madame Butterfly, Cho-Cho-san, which was her name, was a girl of good family. But her father had fallen out with the powers that be. And at one point, this comes up in the opera, he is handed a sword from the political party that was on the winning side, and he knew what it meant. He had to commit harakiri, seppuku, suicide, which he did. So then that left Cho-Cho-san and her mother abandoned with no means of income. So even though they were from a good samurai family, what were they to do? So she becomes a tea house entertainer. We don't have, Marisha, and this is one of the hard things with this opera, the equivalent. We really do not understand the classes of these different distinctions of women in Japan at that time. It was closed. And now this is part of the intrigue, of course, of the Butterfly story in the beginning. When the ports did begin to open, everyone was fascinated about what went on in the willow flower land. And everything that came out of there, the art, the culture, calligraphy, it led to the movement called Japonisme, where the West and America had Japanese lacquered screens and all these things in their homes.
And a lot of artists were very much influenced
exactly.
by that movement in Europe.
Exactly. So there was much more going on than the sailor going ashore for a quick fling, certainly on her side. She knew about the arrangement, of course. She knew there was money involved, but she made the mistake of falling in love with this gorgeous tenor.
And the consul advises Pinkerton, look, she believes this. Don't break her heart. You know, you're getting yourself into really hot water and getting her into even worse trouble. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, but, you know, she's so tender and sweet and lovely. I don't care, and I'm going to marry an American wife later.
That's right. That's exactly the plan. And that's what they did. Historically, these merchants or these seamen would go have these brief arrangements. Then they would leave, go back to wherever they came from, Germany, France, England, wherever it was, America, and marry a woman from their own country and have family and forget. So it was a sort of a tragic little situation that Puccini picked up on. And actually, in the first piece of music we're going to play, we'll hear from Pinkerton. He's not one of, you know, opera's greatest heroes. He's no hero at all.
He is a butt aperture, I'm sorry.
He's a very bad boy. His first aria, Dovunque al Mondo, he says all over the world, wherever a sailor goes, he can have girls in every port. And he sings about this, and he's with Sharpless, and Sharpless is a little skeptical.
That's the consul.
He's a little, he's sympathetic. He's observed Butterfly, and he says, beware, be careful. She's into this much more deeply than you are. But Pinkerton doesn't really care, so he jumps to his feet at the end of this section, and he proposes a toast to America. And you'll actually hear the American national anthem. So.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this. You hear some very American pieces of music, and then some very Oriental Japanese piece of music throughout, which I'm sure we'll talk
exactly
about.
And coming from an Italian who'd never been to Japan,
and the whole thing is sung in Italian.
I know, it's amazing, but that's one of the wonders of the conventions of opera. So let's hear Dovunque al Mondo from the very beginning of Madama Butterfly, and in this recording it's Marcello Giordani.
Dovunque al mondo lo Yankee vagabondo
So that's the opening of Madama Butterfly, and immediately you have a sense of the clash of cultures of East and West, which is one of the major aspects, I suppose, of this opera. A little later, during the wedding ceremony, we hear the Japanese national anthem.
Right.
And the Japanese people were not at all happy about that when this first happened. They were very uncomfortable that it should be used in this context.
So the story of Madama Butterfly, and we will continue to tell the story in just a moment, but it goes far back beyond Puccini. Chrysanthemum?
Madame Chrysanthemum was one of the first tales. In 1855, there was a French naval officer called Pierre Loti who entered into one of these brief marriages with a girl called Madame Chrysanthemum. Now, he used this as a sort of the way to get into a documentary about the life and times and style of Japan. It was sort of a technique to tell the story.
Now, this was a real person.
This was a real person, and it was a true story. And she for her, it was a business arrangement. There's a wonderful piece at the end where Lottie takes a sad farewell of Madame Chrysanthemum and he leaves, but he's forgotten something and he comes back the following morning. He's given her a lot of money, and when he comes back to the house, he climbs the stairs and he hears a little chink, chink, chick. He can't figure out what it is. And he opens the door, and there is Madame Chrysanthème sitting on the ground with a little mallet tapping each of the silver coins he had given her to see that they were real.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a sweet story.
So she's somebody who's not going to actually get her heart shattered.
Absolutely not. To her, she understood. It was a business arrangement. And there wasn't the drama. That came later with the story of Madame Butterfly. Actually, the Lottie story was turned into an opera by the French composer Messager. And that was one of the first pieces to sort of open the doors to this Japonisme. Later then, there were a couple, Jenny Correll and her husband, who ran the American Methodist Mission in Nagasaki. This is in the 1890s. And Jenny, years later, reported that she first heard the story of Cho-Cho-San when she was living in Nagasaki. And these are the actual words of Jenny Correll, from which the opera really is based. She said, "On the hill opposite ours lived a tea house girl. Her name was Cho-San, Miss Butterfly. She was so sweet and delicate that everyone was in love with her. In time, we learned that she had a lover. That was not so strange, for all tea house girls have lovers if they can get and hold them. Cho-san's young man was quite nice, but very temperamental, of a moody, lonely disposition. One evening there was quite a sensation when it was learned that poor little Cho-san and her baby had been deserted. The man had promised to return, had even arranged a signal so Cho-san would know when his ship had come in. But the little girl wife waited in vain. Many an hour and many a long night did she peer from her soji over the lovely harbour, but to no purpose. He never returned." Now, the fascinating thing about this snippet is that much of this is in the opera. The Madame Butterfly, the famous aria, Un Bel Di, One Fine Day, where she stands with the telescope overlooking the harbor, waiting for him to come back.
Right.
That's actually in the opera. So this story then, Jenny, when she came back to the States, she told it to her brother, who was a lawyer and a publisher of the Century Illustrated magazine in Philadelphia. And he wrote the whole thing up. His name was John Luther Long, and he published it as Madame Butterfly in 1898. Now, the big change he made in this work was that he gave the dramatic component to Butterfly. He turned it into the incredible story that we know.
In the Jenny Correll story, was the lover also an American?
It's not said. That's all we know. He was a foreigner, but that's all we know. In fact, that's all there is. That's the sort of the germ of the story, which was then picked up by John Luther Long and developed in his story. He focuses on the tragedy and the drama, though the ending of his story is different again. At the very end, where Madame Butterfly knows that Pinkerton has come back with his American wife to take their child. The last line is this. He ends his tale this way. In the opera, she kills herself. But in the John Luther Long story, the last line says, "When Mrs. Pinkerton called next day at the little house on Higashi Hill, it was quite empty. They had disappeared."
Yeah, so she runs. Well, this is another thing about this story, which is that he's such a scoundrel and such an insensitive and unkind human being, this Pinkerton, that he goes off, breaks this girl's heart, forgets about her, comes back with his wife to take away her toddler.
Three years of age.
Basically all she had in life.
Exactly.
And she's supposed to give him her toddler and this wife whose heart seems to be made of ice cubes, says, we'll take much better care of it than you could.
Actually, it was even worse. In John Luther Long's story, there's a scene where Kate Pinkerton, and really she's blameless. She knows there's a child, but she doesn't really understand what happened. She goes to meet with the consul, Sharpless, in his office, and he's meeting with Butterfly at that time. So he quickly puts Butterfly into another room so he can talk to the American woman, who comes in and says, "Will you send a telegram to my husband, Pinkerton?" It's the first time Butterfly hears this. She overhears it, and she's horrified. And then as the American woman leaves, she sees the young Japanese girl, and she says, "How charming, how lovely you are. Will you kiss me, you pretty little plaything?" I mean, it gets worse and worse.
Right.
And Butterfly at that point literally falls apart and decides that she will kill herself with her father's sword, because as she picks it up, she reads, "To die with honor when one can no longer live with honor." So it's her great sense of honor, this child who becomes a mother and then a noble character at the end where she kills herself because of honor.
Wouldn't it be nobler to take your toddler and get the heck out of there?
Well, that's what happened with John Lutherlong. Yeah, she tried suicide. Apparently, Suzuki bound up her wounds, her maidservant, and they just disappeared. And you wonder what happened to them. Well, that's the end of the story. It's a good ending to the story. But, of course, it doesn't allow for the fantastic ending of the opera where the tenor, Pinkerton, comes running up the hill too late.
Right.
Pinkerton was always too late and crying out, butterfly, butterfly, and it's all over. And we're left with tissues in the audience, tears.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, if it's well done, that's a very affecting moment, what Puccini does with the music at that point. And I think, again, Mary Shelley points up something that I think is very true. One needs to be in the theater to experience this.
Well, and that's the thing. I saw it on DVD. I've been trying to prepare for all of these conversations mm-hmm. that you and I are having because the season hasn't started yet, by watching some version of it on DVD. And the whole, I mean, that's another discussion that we could take on forever, which is, can you make an opera into a movie? Is it like basically filming a stage set?
Well, to me, it's another art form. It's another genre. It's another way of presenting it. It is opening up opera to millions of people.
Yeah.
The numbers are staggering, the Met screenings that are being done each winter. And for
but
us, it's
those
great.
Those are staged. Those aren't really movies.
Those are staged. I mean, it really doesn't matter which way it comes across. So if you think of the Franco Zeffirelli La Traviata, which is actually filmed in a house in the middle of Paris, it's such a house that Violetta would have lived in, that is very affecting.
Yeah.
It's very effective. But I see that as another art form almost. It does not beat the real thing. You are not as into it. The music doesn't reach you in quite the same way. I mean, you get close-ups that you never get unless you're sitting on the fourth row, and sometimes they're all too much. I mean, sometimes a little distance is good. It's another way of doing it. And I don't think we're as focused when we're at home with a DVD. Definitely not. There's too much else going on. You know, you're reading or the phone rings or something happens. You do not have that total sitting alone in the darkness with all these other people. To me, opera, and actually all visual theater, performing arts, it is a community experience. You're alone, but you're not. You're sharing. The Ring is such a good example of this. You sit 16 hours next to two strangers and you're bonded by the end. There's some extraordinary phenomenon here. But I really think you do have to experience it in the flesh, in a theater, with all the stuff that goes with it, the lighting, sets, costumes, and allow the music and the story to work its magic.
Let's hear some more music from Madame Butterfly.
Yes, let's play Butterfly's entrance. This is where they have just had the toast, and then the music changes, and then over the hill come Butterfly and her friends, all dressed in these extraordinarily beautiful kimonos, the wedding kimonos. And at the Santa Fe Opera, this is so extraordinary because they come from upstage. They seemingly come out of the night sky over the top of the hill. And Higashi Hill was always it's a very steep hill. You're sort of breathless when you get to the top, which is appropriate for Butterfly. She's breathless as she arrives and she sees Pinkerton and they're about to be married. So let's listen to a little of Madame Butterfly's entrance.
Thank you.
So let's talk for a moment about the wedding between Madame Butterfly and Pinkerton. Mm-hmm. This was an example of the culture clash that we've
Yes, exactly. Then Butterfly's entrance really points that up because it comes right on top of his singing. He jumps to his feet and says, "This is a toast to the American wife I'll have one day." And then Butterfly appears. I mean, the way that's done is quite incredible. So then they have a very sort of formal wedding that Pinkerton's a bit skeptical of the whole thing. I mean, he just wants to get her to bed. He's not really too interested in going through the ceremony. But halfway through the ceremony, there's a chaos going on off stage, and the Bonds appears. The Bonds is Butterfly's uncle, who is a Shinto Buddhist priest, and he has learned that she has been at the American Methodist mission. And Butterfly says to Pinkerton, she said, "I want to know about your God. I want to have the faith of my husband," which is reasonable, but the Bonds has found out, and he's absolutely furious, and he condemns her, and he curses her, and he takes all of the wedding guests out with him, and she is left alone with Pinkerton. He literally orders him out. He says, "I can't be doing with this. Get out of here." And they leave. And she's a little tearful and unhappy. And she even asks him, she says, "Is it true in America that when you catch butterflies, you stick pins in them and put them up on a board?" And he's ready for this. He says, "Yes, it is true. We do that so that they won't escape and I can hold you forever." So she succumbs to all of this, and it leads into one of the most incredibly beautiful love duets of all opera, the great love duet that ends the first act. But let's hear a little of the Bonds, his entrance and his condemnation of Madame Butterfly in the middle of her wedding. Heartbreaking, isn't it? It's heartbreaking how this comes out. This young girl who's fallen in love with this man, she's suddenly cursed and all her wedding guests leave.
Well, and when you think about it, not only does she have to deal with the fact that her husband is a scoundrel, but she's been cursed by her uncle. She doesn't have a chance.
Exactly, and she's now totally isolated because nobody will come near her. And in the following months and years, she only has Suzuki, this friend maidservant, who stays with her. She is literally on her own.
And the Suzuki part is a mezzo-soprano who doesn't have all that much singing to do, but is a very nice part.
It's an important role, yes. She always maintains her faith. So at the beginning of the second act, for instance, when it opens, Suzuki is praying to the Shinto gods, and Butterfly berates her a bit. She said, "This is an American household now. We don't act like this." But when the end comes, Butterfly herself reverts back to her own faith and her own tradition because she's been abandoned by both Pinkerton and his god.
One of the things that we just heard in the music that we heard a moment ago was this. I mean, you have, okay, Puccini, you're singing in Italian, the music is this traditional classical opera and or romantic, And you have these kind of American, you know, little quotation from the Star Spangled Banner here and there, things like that. And you also have this pentatonic music, which we just heard.
Yes, the pentatonic scale, which is a five-note scale as opposed to our seven-note. So that would have been something different, this sound for Western audiences. And it does give a real sense of a Japanese kind of music. Puccini, though he had never been to Japan, had a good friend, the wife of the Japanese ambassador to Rome, I think. And he met with her, and she introduced him to many Japanese themes and little songs. There are actually seven Japanese themes in this opera. Another time we could go through those. But it does permeate the music, and it gives this wonderful sense. And it's a five-note scale as opposed to our Western seven-note scale.
So. And even if you have no idea what any of that means, you know what
you get the
Asian
sense of it.
Music
yes, exactly.
feels like.
Yes, you get that sense. And in some of the instrumentation, you hear this as well. So the first act ends with the love duet and then the intermission. And then the second act opens 3 years later. Butterfly hasn't heard a word from Pinkerton, but she does believe that she's still married to him because he has continued to send money. And that, she believes, means that they are still married. If he'd stopped sending money, then she would probably have got on with her life. She also did not tell him that she has a child, their child, and the boy is now 3 years old. His name is Trouble, and she tells the child that his name will be changed to Joy when his father returns. So she stands by the window. This is one of the great beautiful images of this opera, by the Soji, looking down on the port of Nagasaki below, and she's searching with the telescope for the one ship, the Abraham Lincoln, which was Pinkerton's ship, and it doesn't come. But I think at this point, when she sings the famous aria Un Bel Di, One Fine Day, she's beginning to doubt. And people don't typically know the words of what this opera means. It's always in Italian, of course. Can I just tell
Please.
You what it is? It's one fine day we will see a wisp of smoke rising at the furthest edge of the sea. Then the ship will appear, the white ship will enter the harbor and fire its gun in salute. Do you see he has come? I won't go down to meet him, not me. I'll station myself there on the rim of the hill and I'll wait. I'll wait a long time and the long wait won't bother me. Then, emerging from the city's crowd, a man, a tiny dot, will make his way up the hill. Who will it be? And when he arrives, what will he say? What will he say? He will call Butterfly from the distance. I will make no answer, but will keep hidden, partly as a joke, and partly so I don't die at our first meeting. So you get a sense of the dreamlike quality that exists here in Butterfly's words, right from that first line, the wisp of smoke, which gives the whole setting a sense of the unreal, of the illusion of love that she lives in that is not reality. So I'm going to play the recording here with Cristina Gallegos Damas singing Madama's Butterfly's Un Bel Di. hate to come out of that, but you'll have to go and see the show at the Santa Fe Opera this
summer. Well, we can't play the whole opera on a 1 hour show, and it's more important to talk about it. I mean, that what you said before, this whole illusion of love. I mean, in a way, you know, mom and dad should bring their girls to see this and say, daughter, this is what not to do.
Well, again, the cultural clash is the big overlay, and that's a little hard to describe. Though having said that...
Although I don't know that this is specifically Japanese, but it was written by an Italian.
Yeah, well, yes, who was a pretty big flirt in his own right, as it turned out. In fact, during the composition of this opera, something really horrendous happened in his own life along these lines. He was married to Elvira, who was a very jealous woman because she knew about his little affair. And he had bought himself a brand new automobile. He loved flying around in this car. These are the early cars, right? The car rolls over at one point and onto him and breaks his leg. This is during the composition of Butterfly. So he is grounded for a while, and they hire a girl from the village to take care of him, Doria Manfredi. And Doria apparently fell in love with the maestro, and Elvira was absolutely sure they were having an affair. So she said terrible things about the girl. She absolutely ruined her reputation in the village. Puccini said that it was absolutely not true, that the girl looked after him and he was fond of her, but nothing else. There had been no other relationship. It got so bad that Doria took poison and died over a 3-day period.
Oh,
I mean,
Lord.
It was that horrendous. And they did an autopsy at her death and found she was a virgin.
Mm.
So then there was a major court case, and Puccini left the villa, Torre del Lago at the time, and he abandoned Elvira. But as time went on, these two seemed to need each other. They did come back together again, but it was really damaging to their relationship, as you can imagine. So, you know, all this stuff is going on in the
background. He could have written another opera.
Absolutely. And he got diabetes on top of it. So these were not good years, but the opera is great. I mean, Puccini is in love with his heroines. And Madama Butterfly was always his favorite heroine. He always said, of all his great operas, his 11 great operas, she was the one that he loved, because the development is so great from this child bride through young woman through the woman who is able to take her life because of what she believes in.
Now, so, you're going to be doing a reading at Collected Works Bookstore.
That's right. That's
Let's
coming
talk about
up.
That.
Yes, that's going to be on June 21st. That's a Monday at 6 p.m. And I'm going to actually read the story, the original story by John Luther Long, called Madame Butterfly. It's really intriguing, and if people are interested in the source of this opera, that's something to hear. The book is long out of print. I mean, it was published in 1898, so the writing style is a bit in that style. But it gives you a lot of insights to the lifestyle in Japan at the time, because this came directly from Jenny Correll, John Luther Long's sister, who had given him the original story. So that's open and free to everyone. So please come to the wonderful new Collected Works. Have you
you've
been there?
Yes, of course.
There's a wonderful...
It's not so very new anymore.
No, I suppose. But there's a wonderful performing space in there that they didn't have before, that a lot of people can sit. And I've been to some wonderful readings there. So
yeah, and it's a cafe, and they have nice coffees and pastries and things.
Right, so Collected Works on Monday the 21st at 6 o'clock. So
right,
that would
here
be good.
In Santa Fe.
Right here in Santa Fe. It's all happening in Santa Fe all the time. Too much.
We're going to take a little break now, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. And we're back talking to Desiree Mays about Madame Butterfly by Giacomo Puccini.
And now we should move on into the second act, where Butterfly goes to meet with Sharpless to say, have you heard from my husband? And then there's a very poignant, very sweet little moment here when she asks him, Butterfly says, when do the robins make their nests in America? And Sharpless is a bit taken back. He said, I don't understand. She said, well, do they nest every year? She said, the birds have nested 3 years now, and my husband has not returned. And he told me he would return with the robins. And Butterfly, Sharpless is really confused. I mean, he sees what's going on. He understands. And he says, I'm not an ornithologist. Even I can't say
ornithologist.
That word. Ornithologist. There you go. They stumble over it in the opera as well. And now he has a letter from Pinkerton. He's trying to tell her its contents. He knows that Pinkerton is returning with the wife. But when this little scene happens about the robins and her discussion and her total faith in Pinkerton, the fact that he'll return, he doesn't have the heart to tell her. He cannot tell her the contents of the letter. At that point then, and here we do hear a truly Japanese piece of music, in the selection I'm going to play. Goro has arranged for another husband, a prince, Yamadori, has come to seek her hand in marriage, and she totally dismisses him. She's polite, as she must be, and she reverts back again to Japanese ritual and custom, but she's not going to have anything to do with Yamadori, which, of course, turns out to be a big mistake. But let's hear...
Yeah, she could have married this perfectly good Japanese guy with lots of horses. And
yeah, but she's in love, Mary Charlotte, yeah, and well, she has a child, and you know, you do crazy things in those situations. So let's hear some of this wonderful duet between Madama Butterfly and the consul Sharpless.
Come dite?
Sì, prima dopo di qui.
Ma perché? Magnoro, non ho studiato ornitologia.
Ornitologia? Non lo sapete, insomma.
No, dicevamo.
Ah sì, Goro appena appena finito. Fui in mare, mi vengono ad assediare. Con Charlie con presente per ridarmi uno questo quel marito.
That's the entrance of Yamadori to a traditional Japanese tune.
Right.
So she leaves Sharpless, not knowing what's happening, and goes home, and lo and behold, she and Suzuki look through the telescope and they see the ship arriving in the port.
The American flag.
The American flag, the whole thing. And she says, let's fill the house with flowers. And they pick all the flowers around the house, and she says, dress me in my wedding kimono. Suzuki helps her dress, and she stands by the soji, and the two women sing this absolutely gorgeous duet, the soprano and the mezzo-soprano, as they gather flowers with the help of the three-year-old. It's a touching moment. He runs around picking flowers and adding them to the flowers.
And you're watching it going,
and
oh,
you're knowing.
No.
Yeah, we know. The audience, it's one of those situations where we know, she doesn't, but we do. And then they wait. And this is one of the most amazing parts of this opera. It was very unique, and it was a situation that totally attracted Puccini to the piece. When the story of Butterfly first came out, it was David Belasco, the great playwright in the States, who picked it up, wrote a play, and presented it on Broadway. And the key central part of this play was Madama Butterfly's wait, where she stands at the soji through the long evening, and it's all done with lighting and stage effects. It's a 15-minute section in the play where the actress doesn't speak, nor does the singer sing.
15 minutes.
15 minutes.
That's a long time sitting in your seat in the audience.
Exactly. So it goes from the night as the end of the day and through dusk and nightfall and then into the following morning, and you hear the sounds of the port waking up later on. And this is the moment of the famous humming chorus. And Puccini saw this and he so fell in love with this image that he went backstage to Belasco and he says, I have to have this opera. And Belasco is reported to have said, what do you do with an impulsive Italian with tears pouring down his cheeks and his arms around around your neck, you say yes. And that's how Puccini got the contract, got agreement from the playwright for the piece. So let's hear a little of the humming chorus. I think this is something that will be familiar to everyone. And this is in the night part where Butterfly stands with Suzuki by her side and the boy also. They poke three little holes in the Soji to look out at the port as they're waiting for Pinkerton's return. Goes on, of course, through the whole of that night scene, and the lighting effects are part of the magic of the scene. But by then you are emotionally so caught up in the drama, knowing what's about to happen. She doesn't. She thinks that he will return.
And by the time he doesn't return, it's morning, she goes to sleep, mm-hmm. and then he shows up with the wife, mm-hmm. wanting to take away their child, and then he becomes kind of a blithering idiot. And
well, he has a moment of regret. This was not in the first score. Puccini realized that Pinkerton needed an aria, so at this point he sings a very beautiful, touching little aria, Addio Fiorito Asil, Goodbye Little House of Flowers. And he has a moment of regret, and he can't face her.
Well, so he has a big moment of regret, but he's a giant coward because he says, right. Oh my God, look what I've done.
Exactly.
And I've spawned a child and I've broken somebody's heart. I'm out of here.
Yeah, he runs. And the music, you can hear the running. It's running music. He runs away and Sharpless is left to deal with it. So Butterfly then wakes up. She says, where is he? Where is he? Expecting to see him, and sees the strange woman, Kate Pinkerton, in the garden and knows what's happening. So she makes up her mind. She tells Sharpless, she says, please tell Pinkerton to come back in half an hour for his son. And at that point, when they have gone, she takes down her father's samurai sword, reads that inscription, to die with honor when one can no longer live with honor, and kills herself as Pinkerton comes rushing up the hill too late, crying her name, and falls in a heap on her body.
Right, and says goodbye, and her last breath, maybe she gets a look at him or maybe she doesn't. Are they supposed to have had real eye contact before?
That's up to the director. Yeah. We'll find out. You have to go to the show to see that.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have time to listen
to this last addio,
but... it's been, of course, as always, wonderful having you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled and the nightly lecturer at the opera's Preview Buffet. You can find them on the web at santafeopera.org, and their number is 505-986-5900. Once again, this week, the Santa Fe Opera is doing a different opera every night. So on the Radio Cafe, we're running our opera series with Desiree Mays, talking about the opera that's on stage tonight. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Many thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Thank you.
Thank you.